This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
On October 24th, there's going to be a talk and a book signing for a book that is not considered it's well-read, maybe I should say. It's not a bestseller in the classic sense of like Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind or something like that. But it is interesting, especially if you are a student of the civil rights movement. And we have with us the author of the book, which is now going into its second edition. IU Northwest professor Jack Bloom is with us to talk about, and he will spend time talking on the 24th about his book, which is entitled Class, Race, and the Civil Rights Movement. And Professor Bloom, thank you for being with us today on the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, let's ask the obvious question. Will you please take a minute and tell us a little bit about the book, which is now, as we said, going into the second edition. So there are obviously some people that are very interested in the book, and you wanted to make some changes in the book. But tell us first, what got you into the idea to put the book together and to have the first edition published?
Well, I came of age in the civil rights movement, and it deeply affected my life and my way of thinking. So when I sat down to write what was my first book, I wanted to ask myself the question, how and why did this happen? And so I started digging. And what it became to me, what happened was that blacks were able to make changes in the 50s and 60s when they'd never before been able to do so. Why? What changed to make that possible? That was the question that I posed to myself. And as I started digging in, I realized that in order to understand that, I had to understand what was it that they were confronting and where did that come from. And that took me all the way back to Reconstruction, actually. And what I found was that the rest of the 19th century was a war, essentially, that went on in the South over who was going to run things, who was going to be on top. Because when the Civil War ended slavery, but that left open the whole question of who was going to work for whom and under what conditions. And so that's what I dug into. And what I found was that this long battle that took place ended up with the former slave owners on top. They created the system. And it was a system they had a political party, the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party used to be the party of white supremacy and of states' rights. Mm-hmm. And they had a means of warfare, that is guerrilla warfare, that is the Ku Klux Klan, which they used to suppress any opposition. What they did finally was they took the vote away from blacks, but the amendments to the Constitution that were put through during Reconstruction gave the vote to blacks, and so they couldn't take away the vote on the basis of race. But the Constitution says nothing about class. And so they enacted a number of class remedies to keep blacks from voting, which also kept large numbers of whites from voting as well. In some states, as many as 60% of the white population lost the right to vote when blacks lost the right to vote. And so that was the situation that they were facing as they came into the 50s and 60s. What changed to make it possible for them to challenge it? What I found was that the Great Depression and World War II fundamentally changed the economy of the South so that business rather than agriculture became the main source of income, and an elite based on that business also grew up. Now, that elite was just as racist as the old elite was, but they had a vulnerability which the old elite didn't have. The old elite was perfectly able and did many times use violence to prevent any challenge to their rule. The new elite, business people, couldn't do that because if they had used violence, what would happen was business people don't like to go to places where there's turmoil. That's not where they want to invest. And for example, in 1957, Little Rock, Arkansas was under court order to desegregate its school.
Right.
And 9 black students were supposed to go into the high school. They were kept out. They were kept out by both mobs and by the National Guard, brought in by the governor of Arkansas. Well, eventually what happened was the president nationalized the National Guard and then sent in paratroopers who he kept in the school for a whole year. What were the consequences of this? For years after World War II, Little Rock had been the recipient of millions of dollars of investment. For 5 years, starting in 1957, they didn't get a penny because of this turmoil that they created. The result of that was, and also they ended up closing the schools in Little Rock and also in a couple schools in Virginia. And what that did was that attacked not only the business people, but the middle class. Because what middle class people have to give to their children is not a fortune, but an education. And they closed the schools down. This brought the middle class out, and both in Little Rock and in Virginia, they overturned the school boards, recalled them, put in new school boards, and essentially went along with the program which the Supreme Court had outlined in its 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling. So that was what made it possible. It didn't make anything inevitable. If something was going to happen, blacks were going to have to organize and create it. And that's what happened. And so all that turmoil of the civil rights movement, which became best known in Birmingham and in Selma, Birmingham in 63 and Selma in 65, and the result of the Birmingham demonstrations was the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and the result of the Selma demonstrations was the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So that's what changed to make it possible, and then blacks had to change themselves and organize themselves, and they succeeded in doing so.
I note that the book's been out there and been in use, I guess, for more than 30 years. You mentioned, and other people have mentioned apparently too, about the fact that the subject of class hadn't been brought up, and other publications are out there, other text or academic books of the sort. Is that your thinking, why the book has been used for so long in the first edition, and you've expounded on that here in this latest edition?
That's one of the main reasons. Yeah. The other main reason for it was that I looked at how blacks themselves changed. It was not an easy process. They had been kept subjected. Many of them bought that they were inferior. This was something that both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X railed about. Malcolm X, you know, talked all the time about how people were, for example, putting on skin lighteners and straightening their hair to look like whites. King, you know, did the same sort of thing. And so they had to overcome that. And in the process, in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, they succeeded in doing that.
In this second edition that has come out, that you're going to talk about in more detail in the talk later this month, you said you wanted to kind of add to some updates in a way. But in particular, there's one point that you mentioned that you wanted to add a chapter that would talk about the long-term consequences of the movement. Is that something that this, over time that maybe you brought up in classes where you taught the subject, and then you thought that maybe it was time to put it in the book?
Yes, you know, I've become increasingly aware of what happened. The movement to try to stop desegregation in the South in the 50s and 60s was called the Massive Resistance Movement. And one of the things that this book does is it shows how and why that movement failed. What I didn't really fully understand at the time was that that was not the only form of resistance to desegregation. That, in fact, there were other less obnoxious ways of trying to turn things around. And that is what has proceeded. That is, what the most significant thing I think that has happened since the Civil Rights Movement has been the rise of the right. It's, you know, starting with the election of President Nixon, and then with who talked about the Southern strategy, although it even began before then. Barry Goldwater, for example, ran in 1964 while Republican senators and congresspeople voted for the Civil Rights Act and for the Voting Rights Act in a higher proportion than Democrats did, because Southern Democrats were against it.
Right.
Barry Goldwater was one of the few non-Southern senators who opposed the Civil Rights Act. And that kind of began to redefine the Republican Party, which previously had been, in many ways, a liberal party. It had grown out of Lincoln. Right, and Lincoln had been for changing the way that blacks were treated, not just ending slavery, but giving them citizenship rights as well. And so now the Republican Party was beginning to change, and it continued to do so under Nixon. It continued to do so under Reagan and under the Bushes. so that by the end of the last century, the Republican Party had become a party where people who were white supremacists could still feel comfortable.
Bringing up to the 21st century now, do you think, in what you put in the book in both editions, the first original edition and now the second edition, as it's come out with the editions that you put in, do you still find it, or is it even now more relevant these days because of all that has happened following through and all the changes that are being at least pushed anyway to the civil rights movement?
Well, there's been a long-term effort to push back the gains of the civil rights movement. And they've had some very significant successes, the biggest of which has been that they've kind of gutted the Voting Rights Act, so that today it doesn't carry the kind of strength, really, that it once had in terms of protecting the right to vote. So, absolutely, I mean, the rise of the right has been partly, significantly, about rolling back the gains of the civil rights movement.
Coming up on October 24th, we have not only the book signing, where folks can get signed a copy of the second edition of Class, Race, and the Civil Rights Movement, but also you're going to have a talk. Are you going to base a lot of the talk coming up on the 24th on obviously the book itself and about the changes that you put in and that you've seen over the recent years?
Absolutely. That's what it's going to be about. And one thing I should mention also is that the rise of the right has come about partly, as I say, in response to the civil rights movement, but not entirely so.
Right.
That is, what we saw in this country in sort of the center of the 20th century was something kind of unusual. This country, for example, went through a very lengthy period of conservatism following the Civil War and Reconstruction. It was turned over as a result of the Great Depression and the election of Roosevelt, the institution of of the New Deal, the creation of the unions, the growth of the middle class as a result of that, and all that now is being rolled back, both the economic gains of the New Deal and later of the Great Society, and the gains of the Civil Rights Movement. All of them are being pushed back nowadays.
Professor Bloom, are you finding it surprising, or you've kind of expected that the book has picked up the popularity in a way that it has? It's an academic book, so you wouldn't necessarily think it's like a bestseller, but I know it's been kind of likened to it being a bestseller.
Well, it's an academic bestseller,
okay.
Meaning that it sold about 11,000 copies, and many more than that have read it. Mm-hmm. I was surprised. I didn't realize that. When I was concerned about the question of class and race, it hadn't really fully dawned on me that very few others had been. And so this entered an issue which hadn't really been talked about either in academia or in popular areas.
IU Northwest Professor Jack Bloom's book is entitled Class, Race, and the Civil Rights Movement. It's now going into the second edition. In fact, that's the topic of the discussion is coming up on October 24th on the Gary campus, where Professor Bloom is offer a little talk and then do some signing of the books as well. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about the book, and we hope that you have a good following, and certainly enough people come by and get that second edition signed if they haven't done so.
Well, thank you for having me here.
The Porter County Public Safety Communications System, as it is called, is now in line with the rest of the state. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke with Portage Mayor John Cannon last week about why the upgrade was needed, how it benefits Porter County, and what it took to finally get the job done.
So tell me about the countywide upgrade to the Porter County Public Safety Communications System. Why was the upgrade needed?
Well, the upgrade was needed. It was required by the state to get us all on the same megahertz radio system, and it was part of the E911 Integrated Public Safety Commission process through the state officials.
When did the project finally come to a close?
Well, it went on yesterday. Went up yesterday morning, and then it's worked overnight and all day today perfectly. So that's what we were waiting for.
And how is the communication system better now than before?
Well, we can speak to the rest of the state. Prior to that, Porter County was on an antiquated old system. The rest of the state was connected with towers and connected with the rest of the counties in the state. And we were the lone island up here in northwest Indiana between Lake and LaPorte County and then our Jasper and Newton. We were not able to talk with them over the megahertz. We had to either do it the old-fashioned way by picking up the phone or cell phones because we were the only ones on the 800 megahertz.
So you guys were the only ones that weren't part of the new system?
Our county was not, not just Portage, our county. We were not able to speak via the 700 megahertz system to the surrounding counties. We were the only county that was not switched over to the 700 megahertz system.
How come?
Well, there were some difficulties with some towers. The E911 director had been changed over a few times. That delayed it. And when I got here in March, I was told by my chief of police and chief of fire that this was occurring, that that there was a problem with the communications between a couple companies, that the federal government did not allow the two companies to talk to one another because they were competitors. And I just thought that was just kind of, you know, not the correct answer. So I met with Commissioner Biggs of Porter County, and that same day or a couple days later, I was in a meeting with the governor and with Senator Charbonneau, and I told them both, or asked them both if they were aware that Porter County was not on the new integrated public safety requirements, and they did not know that, and they said they would help immediately. And the next couple of days, we had word that the tower in Hebron, which was holding the process up, and the tower at the Port of Indiana that was holding the process up, would be tested and up and running, and we would expect something to be done mid-September. And we just got up. It was ready to go mid-September, but they were doing some testing. Wanted to make sure it was, you know, all the I's were crossed and the T's were dotted and all that. That's funny. I said that the wrong way. But anyway, the system would be up, and it got up yesterday on the 8th of October. So moving along pretty fast. It's been going on at least since 3 years ago, and it was supposed to be up and running March of 2018.
So what time did you guys switch it on?
Yesterday morning. I don't know the exact time.
So I understand that during the process and with the delays you were speaking of, you were concerned that, you know, the first responders were, it kind of put them at a disadvantage, even in danger.
Yes.
Can you tell me why and how?
Well, they you know, we have a lot of cross county encounters with Lake County and LaPorte County on the other side. I mean, I'm particularly concerned about the Lake County side because we border it, and we were unable to speak, you know, with our partners on the Lake County side in law enforcement of you know, switching over a chase of a car or investigating something that might have happened in Lake County but then moved over into Porter County or into Portage. We'd have to do it the old-fashioned way with a cell phone or with just you know, meeting up and talking things over, which is, you really can't do that in a high-speed chase or a tracking situation. You need to have the same radios because when you're tracking someone or chasing someone, you really don't pay attention to the county line. You pay attention to who's up next you can hand it off to. That put our folks in danger, as well as the other side of the county in danger, because they couldn't talk to us and didn't know what was heading their way, maybe. So it put us in danger. Now, we also purchased the radios because we were required to purchase the radios through the Integrated Public Safety Commission 3 years ago, and we've been paying for the police radios all that time, $116,000 a year to set in a closet. And through all that time, if we'd have been on, like we should have been on the system, the upgrades would have came to the radios. Now, before this turn on yesterday, we had to send all of our radios out to get upgraded because what we missed over the last 3 years, that would have came during the system being up. So we were at a disadvantage there as well. They were sitting in a drawer. Now, what's really nice is our fire department had their radios are dual band. They could do the old and the new, so they could speak and communicate with the other counties. And they received those radios and the upgrades through a grant process 3 years ago. So they've been up and running all along. It's just, this just helps alleviate the old system and get us all in the same, so our police and fire actually can talk.
So whose radios are the ones that now need to be upgraded? Police?
They've been all upgraded. And as soon as we knew this was going to go on in September, it gave us about a month to get Mellons to upgrade our police radios.
Very nice.
That, like I said, have been sitting in a closet for 3 years, and we've been paying that bill to Motorola.
Wow. How much did this whole thing cost, this whole upgrade?
$650,000.
Where'd the money come from?
It's been paid for by out of the police budget for the last 3 years, and it'll continue to be that way until we get those radios out of paid for.
Anything else you want to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
No, I think one of the things that's really, really, really important is that the residents know that County Commissioner Biggs, Governor Holcomb, Senator Charbonneau, and I pushed this thing along, all four of us together as a team, working together to get the Hebron and the Port Towers to talk to one another, and to have the two companies that were handing it off to each other to get in a room and get it solved. And that's what really the residents need to know, is that when you work together and don't point fingers, you get stuff done. You get it done pretty quick. And I want to thank Commissioner Biggs, the governor, and Senator Charbonneau for their leadership on this.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio. Sharon Jackson speaking with Portage Mayor John Cannon last week. The country's newest national park isn't like many of the others. It's surrounded by some of the largest industrial companies in the country. And while Indiana Dunes' new designation has drawn national attention, so have the recent industrial spills in nearby Lake Michigan waterways. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel wonders, will the park's designation pressure industrial companies to clean up their act?
Walking along the park's west beach, you wouldn't expect to see a lot of tourists on a weekday afternoon. But since Indiana Dunes became a national park in February, its visitor center has seen more people than it has in any of the past 8 years. But just 6 months later, excess cyanide and ammonia leaked from a nearby steel facility owned by ArcelorMittal, killing about 3,000 fish and forcing one park beach to close temporarily. After that, some tourists weren't sure the dunes were safe. That affected businesses in the area, like Spring House Inn, a small, woodsy retreat at the edge of the park. Kara Howard manages the front desk.
We had a lot of cancellations on reservations, and we had a lot of people who were calling and inquiring about if everything was affected by the chemical spill here at the dunes.
Howard says the inn expects to book nearly all of its rooms on the weekends, but after the spill, it was only about half full. But it's not just tourism at risk when these spills happen. The dunes have some of the most diverse types of plants and animals in the U.S., including many vulnerable species. Now that the dunes are a national park, environmentalists say there's even more reason to protect it. Natalie Johnson is the executive director of the environmental group Save the Dunes. She says when the Port of Indiana was founded in the 1960s, it was supposed to show how you could have a sensitive ecosystem like the dunes alongside pollution-free industry.
And are we pollution-free? The answer is absolutely not.
Some say industrial companies in the Great Lakes Basin are already working hard to be good stewards of the environment. Kay Nelson is the Environmental Affairs Director for the Northwest Indiana Forum, a regional economic development organization.
The discharge permits for any and all entities surrounding all five of the Great Lakes have much more stringent standards for their municipal and industrial discharge facilities than, say, the rest of the state of Indiana that does not discharge into Lake Michigan. So those limits are already very stringent.
But environmentalists say industry isn't doing enough. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal are among the top five companies for most toxic releases in Indiana since 2007. And per square mile, Indiana has the third highest toxic releases in the country. A parks advocacy group, the National Parks Conservation Association, says industrial air pollution, along with emissions from nearby Chicago, are likely having an effect on the plants and animals at the dunes. Colin Deverell is the NPCA's Midwest Program Manager.
Visitors to national parks expect a certain experience. You expect clean air, you expect clean water, you expect natural vistas.
And Deverell says there should be consequences for companies that pollute the park. Back when Indiana Dunes was just known as a national lakeshore, U.S. Steel spilled about 300 pounds of the cancer-causing chemical hexavalent chromium into the Burns Waterway, which feeds into Lake Michigan. The EPA still hasn't finalized a consent decree, which means the company has yet to pay fines for harm caused by the spill.
But what's really needed is that added layer of vigilance, vigilance from people who come to national parks to say, we expect that clean air, we expect that clean water. So businesses, state and federal regulators, do your jobs and protect this place.
Two environmental groups say they'll sue ArcelorMittal if state and federal regulators don't hold the company accountable for its environmental violations. We could not get an interview with the Northwest Indiana industrial companies, U.S. Steel, BP, or ArcelorMittal. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Have you noticed lately the number of seniors that are returning to the workforce? Well, there's some more indications about this. And how does it fit in with the overall scheme of retirement? Well, let's find out more from Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. He's with us always here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first with talking first about the facts about the fact we have more senior workers in the workforce than we probably ever have, haven't we?
Yeah, we do. And, you know, a lot of that, Chris, I think is a reflection of, you know, the fact that people are living longer, number one. So retirement has been stretched out from, you know, what used to be typically 10, 15 years to, you know, more of the 20, 25, even 30 years for a lot of people. And, you know, a lot of your benefits, even Social Security, are the full benefits are being pushed back later. And I think the result is you're seeing, the population begin to age that or before you begin retirement.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the tips that you can pass along to us and tell us about, if we're not aware of, to make sure that we are ready for retirement if we're at that age or approaching that age?
Well, I think first, the government's realizing that they need to do something to allow people to catch up, you know, to put more money towards retirement. And the catch-up provisions continue to increase within our normal retirement vehicles like the 401ks and the IRAs. And those catch-up provisions have increased again this year. You know, for the 401k, you have your standard $19,000 for everybody, but the 50 and over can now contribute an additional $6,000 in contributions to the 401k. And the IRA has gone up to $6,000, and you have a catch-up provision of $1,000.
Mm-hmm. How about looking ahead for, I guess, if we haven't set up a strategy or taken advantage of the ones that are out there to be able to use our tax dollars the best?
Well, I think the biggest thing today is the new tax laws have really created some unique opportunities that just simply didn't exist prior to these tax laws,
mm-hmm,
in terms of which strategies would be the best. And with the tax implications and the rates being as low as they are, the non-taxable contributions like the Roth can be a lot more advantageous than they have been in the past and can help diversify those assets that are sitting in retirement.
And we talked about this before, of course, about trying to plan ahead and literally, in this case, creating an income plan if you don't have one, right?
Well, I think ultimately we've talked about this many times, Chris. It has to start with the end in mind. You know, it's a common phrase that people have heard, but it's kind of hard to get to where you want to go if you don't know exactly what it is you want in retirement or where it is you want to end up.
And, yeah.
And the income plan is first and foremost that map, you know, that guideline. Okay, where is it that I want to go? What are the things I can do? And then actively work on it to constantly improve that plan and try to avoid costly mistakes, but, you know, give you a better idea of what the target is. What do I need to have set aside? What type of assets do I have to have? Where do they have to be in order to accomplish my goals?
Now, for folks that are in retirement or approaching retirement, and they are maybe trying to get things planned out as they can, but, of course, they're looking ahead to trying to decide, well, do I really want to work? Do I want to officially retire, or do I want to continue to work into my retirement year, so to speak? But there's some things that you need to think about, and I know that there are three in particular that you bring up often. Let's bring those up, please.
Sure. I mean, the first thing is, you know, how you envision your retirement. And a lot of folks, they don't like idle time. You know, they've been active their entire careers. They've worked, you know, constantly and consistently their entire careers. And, you know, they feel like, you know, if I continue to work, it's just something that they would enjoy doing, something that they, you know, would feel fit in well with their retirement. But it's a second career that it's something that they enjoy to do. And they have fun doing it, you know, and it adds the additional income.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, you know, part of it is, you know, most people, when they retire, we typically find that the first 5, 8, maybe 10 years of retirement generally are going to have a lot more bucket list items being accomplished, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the nest egg might satisfy their retirement lifestyle, but even with the sizable nest egg, a lot of times they just want to, you know, add to that nest egg for some of the things that they like to do. The key is if you're going to do that, is whatever am I doing, does it give me the flexibility to still maintain, you know, what I see my retirement? So how you envision your retirement is a solely focused on pastimes? Is it focused on grandkids? Is it focused on, you know, just hanging out and relaxing? Whatever it might be, you need to envision that structure that keeps you busy, and working in retirement may be a fit, you know, if you want a more active retirement.
Now, I suppose, too, for example, if you're a businessman and you've decided to step aside from the business or the industry that you happen to have been business in, but you still want to participate and help out with many organizations, in particular like those that are out there that help new businesses get started, get some of their problems resolved, because you have the experience you can put to it. You may not necessarily get paid, but you need to kind of plan ahead if you do want to be able to do that kind of volunteer work and still be able to pay for everything, right?
Absolutely. And, yeah. And again, we sound like a broken record sometimes, but it always goes back to, you know, what's my plan? You know, yeah. Not only the income plan, that income plan really needs to incorporate, you know, how do I envision my retirement? What do I see it as? You know, what are the things I want to do? How do I want to spend my time? You know, we've done what we had to up to that point. Now it's more or less, you know, what do I want to do? And there's a big difference, I tell people, between having and wanting, right? If I want to do some things and maybe I have some passions, I have a lot of friends that have gone through their career, and they might have a charitable interest in mind to say, hey, my passion in retirement, and I want to stay active. I want to figure out how to, you know, create this type of fundraising for this particular organization, or I want to spend time, you know, working in this personal arena because it's something I've always wanted to do, but it couldn't support what I needed to have, you know, during my working years.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. The Indiana General Assembly did not budget any money to continue the Hoosier State Amtrak passenger rail service in this budget year, but the service is far from being dead. Let's find out the latest and some ideas for the future with Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. And Steve, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Good morning, Chris. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for telling us the latest here about the Hoosier State. And we know that the General Assembly wasn't kind in the last budget, but as we mentioned, it's far from being dead. Tell us what the Alliance and other groups that are very much in support of Passenger Rail Indiana have to say these days.
Well, yeah. The battle is far from over. The bottom line, really, with the Hoosier State and the last budget appears to be that Indiana's government simply does not like dealing with Amtrak. They don't view it as a good business partner. And if you go back and look at the history of Amtrak's relationship with the state, Amtrak has never really given Indiana very high priority. And I know also there has been concern in Indiana, but also in several other states and in other transit agencies about Amtrak's accounting methods. They are so opaque that no one can be comfortable that what Amtrak charges them for state service, let's say, is actually a fair price. And that was part of what went into the mix also. State of Indiana simply saw the Amtrak contract as a bad deal. Now, what the Passenger Rail Alliance has proposed is a two-pronged approach, and we've committed this to a short white paper, two pages, one sheet, saying, okay, we understand that there's a problem dealing with Amtrak, but Amtrak isn't the only game in town. State of Indiana quite successfully runs a railroad now. It's called the South Shore, run by the NICTD, which is a state-chartered organization. We have suggested that the state set up a transportation authority along similar lines to run trains between Indianapolis and Northwest Indiana and possibly into Chicago. This dovetails with the South Shore's plans to expand in the Westlake County here with a new station in Dyer, Indiana, which is very close to the existing Amtrak station. It's possible you could have passengers using that route get on the South Shore in Chicago, transfer to an Indiana train in Dyer, and then go the rest of the way down to Indianapolis. You could have a service then that would not need Amtrak's cooperation. It would be owned, operated by the state of Indiana with a schedule and frequency of service that made sense for Indiana. Another parallel track is saying, well, we have the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, which has reached out to the private sector, marketed the Indianapolis airport to get direct flights from Indianapolis to San Francisco and Indianapolis to Paris in France. This service is subsidized one way or another by the state of Indiana. And our suggestion is that, well, why couldn't the Indiana Economic Development Corporation reach out to the private sector and find someone who might be willing for a reasonable amount of investment on the state's part to operate a train service between Indianapolis and Northwest Indiana and Chicago. We've boiled these suggestions down into a white paper, which is in the hands of every member of the Indiana House and every member of the Indiana Senate. The Passenger Alliance is planning then to follow this up with discussions with the leaders in both the House and the Senate, and at some point actually draft proposed legislation and attempt to find a sponsor for it.
Have you got any response back from any of the lawmakers who have got this white paper in hand?
No, it went out just recently, and they're all still kind of on their summer hiatus. So we have not gotten any response back yet.
Do you suspect that this one is going to be one of these cases where it'll end up going to a study committee, if not before, of course, the session, but sometime either after the session or very soon?
It could, and of course, we have the short session starting in January, in which the budget will be reopened for a number of unrelated reasons. What we're planning to do is raise this issue about funding the service during this short session. It is unlikely that we would actually get an appropriation, have the governor reverse his previous decision in this session, but what we want to do is make sure that the issue stays open. And then by the time we have the next budget session, the next long session, that we, you know, can make some progress. And at that point, possibly we will have distributed enough information to enough legislators that something might be worked out.
Do you think, too, that maybe after these municipal elections are over with here in November, that there may be some changes in communities along the Hoosier state line in some way or another that may make a change in how this all comes about to the lawmakers?
Well, there could be, but the thing is the communities, with the exception really of Indianapolis, but including Beech Grove, Indiana, the communities along the line have generally been highly supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Crawfordsville and the Lafayette, West Lafayette area, very supportive. In fact, without naming names, there's some Republican mayors down there who were surprised and actually rather appalled that the governor did not include funding for the Hoosier State in the budget. So I think in terms of the communities along the line, we do have strong support. And that would be regardless of party affiliation, I think. There's pretty strong support in these communities, pretty strong bipartisan support.
Well, Steve, it sounds like there's a lot more to come from this here, that this is really just the start of another set of discussions and probably coming even as recently perhaps as in the last few weeks and continuing on going into this short session of the General Assembly coming up. Thanks for bringing this up. We appreciate it, and we'll have you back again to go into more detail, and I'm sure there's some other mass transportation points we can bring up as well, too.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
You're
have a good afternoon.
Glad to help. Thank you for being with us. This is Steve Coxhead. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. It's been about a month since the United Auto Workers went on strike against General Motors. For communities that rely on the GM plants, the financial strain is being felt from striking union members to local diners and shops. While many businesses are seeing losses, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that some are finding ways to support workers through the strike.
Music lawyers from the speakers as local 2209 union members near Fort Wayne meet for the annual picnic. People grab a bite to eat at the Union Hall. Outside, children run around playing games. UAW member Teresa Braden takes advantage of the late September sunny weather to meet with friends and coworkers. But she says the strike casts a cloud over the celebration. 2 miles down the road, fellow union members are about to go into the second week of the strike against GM.
It seems that everybody has so much on their minds right now. I know inside they still have their positions where you have to sign in to go to the strike lines. Everybody is, it's our talk right now. We're on strike.
But Braden's not on strike. She was temporarily laid off from GM supplier Avanse. The company sits across the road from the now idled Fort Wayne General Motors assembly plant and suspended its own operations shortly after the strike started. Braden's coworker and friend Christy Honeycutt says with no job or steady paycheck, she's had to file for unemployment and cut spending.
just simple things like going out to eat and things like that as well. No, we better not do that because we don't know when we're getting our unemployment check. So just scrimping and saving. But I'm pretty much used to doing that from previous layoffs, but I just didn't want to have to go do it again.
Unlike Detroit, Indiana's four GM facilities are all located in smaller communities: Bedford, Marion, Kokomo, and Roanoke. Industry experts say the economic effects of the strike will be felt quicker in those areas. Kokomo Local 292 shop chairman Greg Wolford says when union members have less to spend, local business suffers as well.
It affects the beauticians, the restaurants, the hotels, you know, all that kind of stuff that people don't realize, because it does. It's like throwing a rock in a pond and you get the ripple effect.
Just a few miles from the Fort Wayne Assembly Plant in Roanoke, McClure's Market and Bulk Foods owner Ashley Black fills produce into buckets for her customers to pick up. She says early on in the strike, business slowed down.
A lot of my weekly customers have had to cut back a little bit. I do fresh boxes where they come in weekly to get their bucket and they get $40 worth of produce for $20. And I've had some come to me and say, can't afford it this week.
Black says she and other local businesses wanted to help those affected by the strike. First, she reduced the produce bucket prices down to $10 for her customers unable to pay the full $20. Then she went one step further.
But then that kind of led to, I need to do something else for everybody else. So I'm giving 25% off to any local 2209 member and anybody else that's affected secondarily through the strike.
Other businesses and organizations in many areas are also helping out. Local United Way groups, restaurants, and the Kokomo Fire Department are offering support to those affected by the strike. On the picket lines, union members say they'll keep striking as long as necessary, even with the financial strain. While the entire community near the Fort Wayne plant is feeling the pains of the strike, Teresa Braden and Ashley Black say when it comes to the small town of Roanoke, they'll help one another as much as they can.
We just want everybody to know that we're in this together and that we really do need to lean on each other.
I'm seeing more people reach out and support the UAW members than I've ever seen. But anytime anybody's in need in this community, they always take care of it.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Indiana is among the worst states in the country for childhood obesity. That's according to some newly released data from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But experts say that the situation is stabilizing. And from Side Effects Public Media, here's Carter Barrett.
Indiana ranks 13th in the country for obesity rates among children aged 10 to 17. This means about 1 in 6 Hoosier children in this age range are obese. But Monica Hobbs Van Leeuwen with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says there is good news for Indiana.
In Indiana, the obesity rate has actually maintained pretty steady over the last few years. So that's, surprisingly enough, that's actually good news, because in some states they've actually had increased rates.
Neighboring Midwestern states didn't fare much better. Kentucky ranks third in the country for the highest childhood obesity rates. Ohio and Michigan also fall within the top 10. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
The Purdue University Board of Trustees adopted a new policy last week that prohibits students and staff from wagering on Purdue sports teams. The decision comes after the legalization of sports gambling in Indiana on September 1st. Purdue President Mitch Daniels says that athletes could have been influenced if their peers or their teachers were placing bets on them.
Just don't think that particular kind of behavior would be appropriate or would fit with the values and identity we associate with Purdue.
The Dean of Students, Katie Sermersheim, has been asked to recommend what sanctions could apply to students and staff who don't comply with the new policy. And the former governor, who is now the president of Purdue, says that it is now in effect immediately. And he also says he hopes that the adopted policy will be perceived as an appeal.
People around them or classmates were betting for or against them or their team, and that it might make them feel very apprehensive, maybe intimidated.
And Daniel says the Board of Trustees could amend the rule in the future. Not clear on how the university is going to police those connected with the institution who choose still to wager on Purdue teams. It's time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are two guests, Amy Wolf, who is the events coordinator, and Jenny Fine, who is food and retail director at Opportunity Enterprises in Valparaiso. And welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Good morning.
And it's nice to have you back. Usually it's sort of an annual visit to talk about the Artability show,
yes,
and sale. The Artability program has been, do you have any idea how long it's been running now? Many years.
And yes. So Artability started in 2007.
Oh, really? I thought it was even further back than that, maybe. But it's a big success every year, I know. Where are you having it this year?
At the VU campus, so it'll be in the Christopher Center Community Room.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice building.
It's a very nice building.
Yeah, they have some nice architecture at Valparaiso University, in my opinion. The best in Northwest Indiana. The best architecture. So that's good that you got to have your event there. Did you have it there last year as well?
Yes, this will be the fourth year at that venue.
Oh, good, good. Mm-hmm. So that gives you lots of space, I would assume.
Yes. We have over 70 canvas art pieces and over 200 pieces of glass art, ceramics, and then new this year we will have prints from previous art shows available for purchase as well.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yes.
Yeah, very good. So first of all, Opportunity Enterprises, how do you describe what the organization does in general?
So the simplest way to say it is we serve individuals with disabilities. And then we have kind of three main categories of services. We do residential services, so mm-hmm. help people with independent living, mm-hmm. Curriculum-based day programming. So that is kind of a business hours, come do different activities, learn different skills during the day. So almost mm-hmm. like a higher education type feel. Mm-hmm. And then we have different employment programs. So we offer employment on our facilities and then also community-based employment.
I see.
And then we have supplementary programs such as Artistic Visions, mm-hmm. which is what provides all of the pieces for the Artability show.
Okay. So Artistic Visions, is that's like kind of the day-to-day program that you do throughout the year?
Right. So clients will come in and they get paired with a skilled art instructor. And so it's a collaboration between the client and the instructor. And they create the canvas art and the ceramics that will be available for purchase at the show.
So is Artability then just the name of the event itself?
Correct.
Okay, so that's the show and sale.
Correct.
And is it just a one night event?
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the
strike while it's hot.
Yes. So it is kind of the culminating activity every year. So the artists work really hard with their instructors all year to create these pieces. Mm-hmm. So some of the canvas art pieces that are for sale, the clients and the instructors will have been working on for 6 or 7 months mm-hmm. To make it a masterpiece.
Well, how many instructors do you have now for art instruction?
Yeah, we currently have 4 very talented art instructors.
That's wonderful, because mm-hmm. I can remember when there was just one, as I recall. Because I'm talking about 20 years ago. I go back a ways. But that was kind of a new thing. When I first started working for South Shore Arts, we were involved on some level mm-hmm. with helping you find an instructor and at Tradewinds, too. Because this was kind of like a new idea that people were trying. And so 4 instructors, that's fantastic. And they would mm-hmm. just work one-on-one.
We do have a couple groups of 4, but usually one-on-one so they get the most attention that they need.
So how many – so you said already, but can you repeat one more time how many pieces will be available on display at Artability?
So total pieces is over 300 with
oh my gosh.
70 of them being canvas art uh-huh. and 200 being a combination of ceramics and glass art.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And then plus the prints.
And how many artists, how many individuals are making the art?
We have 81 individuals who currently participate in the art program. Mm-hmm. Not all of them have canvas pieces, however, but mm-hmm. they probably have a ceramic or glass piece in the show.
So they're still represented.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. And what are the price ranges for the work? So people can buy it is mm-hmm. the thing. You come and see it.
Yeah.
You can actually make a purchase. What are the
price
ranges?
So we kind of have 2 different kind of styles of purchasing. We have all of the canvas art is based on an online auction.
Okay.
So we'll set a opening bid based on how many hours went in, framing okay. costs, etc. Mm-hmm. And then so that those pieces can go anywhere from like $50 to $800. We had a piece go for over $800 one year, so
fantastic.
That was really impressive. And then the ceramics probably range from maybe $5 or $10 for like smaller ornaments mm-hmm. up to
$45 or $50
for large glass bowls.
And does this money go back to the artist or to the Opportunity Enterprises?
So a little bit of both. Uh-huh. For every piece sold, whether it's glass art, a ceramic, or canvas, mm-hmm. or even the prints, the artist will receive a commission mm-hmm. For their work in it. And then any profits after the commission and expenses are paid go back to the Artistic Visions program.
Okay. And the event is on?
Friday, November 15th.
Okay. And you, is there a cost for attending?
No, free and open to the public, yeah. So everybody should come join us.
And refreshments are available, I
believe. Correct. Okay. Absolutely fabulous, delicious desserts from local vendors.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Amy, Jenny, thank you both for being here, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have another edition of Building Northwest Indiana. And we also have Mitch Marloga with NERPC to join us and tell us about a special workshop series that is going to be coming to Portage later this month. We hope you'll join us tomorrow.